You're listening to The Globalist, first broadcast on the 7th of June 2023 on Monocle Radio. The Globalist, in association with UBS. Live from London, this is The Globalist with me, Emma Nelson. A very warm welcome to today's programme. Coming up, we'll have the latest on the flooding following the destruction of the Novokarkova Dam in Ukraine. Also ahead, as the US Secretary of State visits Saudi Arabia, we examine how far down the path to rehabilitation the kingdom has now travelled. We pay tribute to Astrid Gilberto.
That voice that we have all listened to many times at hotel piano bars, and that, like football and samba, will remain associated with Brazil forever.
Plus, you're the president of France and you have to plan for the wars of the future. What's your bedtime reading? We'll find out what's on Emmanuel Macron's list. That's all coming up on The Globalist, live from London. First, a quick look at the headlines. The United Nations says it will be some time before the full effect of the collapse of a dam in Ukraine will be known. The former New Jersey Governor Chris Christie has entered the 2024 race for the White House, and hundreds of passengers on board an Air India flight from New Delhi to San Francisco face a tense wait after an engine problem has forced them to land in the far east of Russia. Stay tuned to Monocle Radio throughout the day for more on these stories. But first, thousands of Ukrainians have been evacuated from their homes after the collapse of a major dam in Russian-held Ukraine. Kyiv has accused Russia of blowing up the dam at Novokarkova. Russia, in turn, has blamed Ukraine. Nonetheless, water is surging down the Dnieper River and is said to pose a catastrophic flooding risk to the city of Kherson. Well, to bring us up to date, I'm joined now by Olga Tokariuk, who's Monocle's Kyiv correspondent, and by Owen Matthews, the author of Overreach, the inside story of Putin's war against Ukraine, and former Moscow bureau chief for Newsweek. A very good morning to you both.
Morning.
Good morning.
Olga, if we can just begin with you. Reuters is beginning to publish some numbers from overnight. It's sort of 1,500 people have been evacuated from their homes, and that 1,500 homes have been flooded on the right bank of the Dnieper River. We don't know what the scale is, but we suspect it is huge.
Yeah, indeed. The first photos and videos also started emerging yesterday of people staying on roofs of their houses, waiting for the evacuation. A lot of people are trying also to evacuate their livestock or their pets. So really impressive emotional images. And there were also reports that Russians are preventing evacuation from some of the settlements that basically Russian occupying so-called authorities in the right bank of Dnipro River in Kherson region. They are telling the population that everything is fine, that there is no need to panic, there is no need to evacuate. So basically all the effort of evacuation is now relying on the volunteers, and that again sparked this massive fundraising campaign in Ukraine of people donating money to volunteers who evacuate people. But there were also desperate cries on social media by people whose relatives are there in these occupied areas that Russians are not letting these volunteers, even they're not granting them access to this flooded settlement, and that people's lives are at risk.
Owen, just developing on that a little bit more, Volodymyr Zelensky has said 42,000 people are at risk here. But there doesn't seem to be any formal evacuation plan for an event like this.
Well, the physics of a dam are such that it's not like the Hoover Dam. I've been to Novokarkovka. I'm sure Olga has as well. It's not 30 meters high. The water difference is about is between 4 to 5 meters. The waters were exceptionally high in the weeks and months running up to this catastrophic failure, which seems to be an explosion, or it was either explosion is more mismanagement, jury's out, but it's definitely the Russians' fault that the dam collapsed. The waters will subside. The further major impact is not so much the flooding downstream, but the fact that the reservoir upstream, the Kakhovka Reservoir, which covers an area larger than Greater London, is going to lower in its level and it's going to disappear. That's the whole point of a dam. It creates a reservoir behind it. And that actually has a really catastrophic impact going forward on four very important canals that irrigate a whole swathe of the Kherson region, north of the Dnipro and also south of the Dnipro, and crucially, the water supply for the Crimean Peninsula. So that is going to be the major economic and environmental impact going forward.
Olga, just build on that for us in terms of what Ukraine stands to lose here. I mean, Owen has just mentioned not the fact that if you are living downstream, you have an immediate threat of flooding. But we are in June and crops are growing and Ukraine is so celebrated for being the breadbasket of Europe. I mean, in what effect are we looking at here?
Yeah, well, absolutely, it will have a devastating effect on this on the Ukrainian economy, because Ukraine will lose part of its most fertile lands, and that will have long-lasting consequences also for the economy and as well for people's lives, because thousands of people will again be forced to abandon their homes. Let's remember that. Many of these people, they have survived the Russian occupation already. Now they are forced to leave their homes because of flooding. Personal histories, of course, again, people will lose their childhood memories in addition to all the material objects that will be flooded and lost. So the landscape of the area will be altered significantly. That will have a profound environmental impact also on the and the ecosystem, on the wildlife, and in the context of the climate change, I think this issue should probably attract more attention also from global environmental organizations. And of course, in the short term, it will also mean that it would make a Ukrainian offensive in the south of Ukraine more difficult.
Well, let's develop that a little further, Owen. How much is this the collapse of the dam going to affect Ukraine's counteroffensive militarily?
Well, assuming that the Russians did it, and it looks increasingly likely that we're going to get some intelligence declassified by the White House in the next days and hours that suggests that it was entirely deliberate. If they did do that, at the cost of cutting off their own territory in Crimea, or what they describe as their own territory in Crimea, from fresh water, the reason has to be pretty compelling. And the compelling reason is that they want to widen the river below Kakhovka and below the dam in order to make it a little bit more difficult for the Ukrainians to mount an amphibious assault into that part of Kherson province and on into Crimea. Now, I mean, the river is already very wide at that point. If you remove the dam, it becomes wider. The overall level goes up. The flow doesn't change, but the overall level goes up and the lower Dnieper becomes wider and slightly more difficult to cross. It seems to me clearly an act of desperation, incredibly poorly thought through. It's disastrous for various economic reasons and environmental reasons, as Olga has outlined. But the military utility of this, I think, is pretty negligible, given that an amphibious assault was not really ever considered to be one of the major points at which the Ukrainians were going to attack across the river at Kherson. That was not really a big part of the plan. No one was really expecting that kind of assault. And furthermore, if the Kakhovka Reservoir now shrinks, as it will do, to the former width of the Dnieper before it was dammed in the 1930s, it would actually make it easier for the Ukrainians to cross that river further up from Kherson. So it's not really clear that there's any kind of logic to this Russian act of desperation, whatever.
And where, Olga, does Russia go next? The top security official to President Zelensky has done an interview with the Times newspaper this morning and said that the whole world should be concerned by how reckless Moscow could be, and has suggested that Russia could plot to blow up the Zaporizhzhia nuclear plant.
Well, there have been, of course, these fears since the start of Russian full-scale invasion of Ukraine and its occupation of the Zaporizhzhia nuclear power plant. The information that we get from there is very limited because people there are being intimidated by occupation authorities. There are reports of kidnappings of family members of the staff of the nuclear power plant. But from those limited reports, we know that the security situation at the plant is deteriorating. One thing that makes the situation at Zaporizhzhia nuclear power plant different from Kakhovka is that there is much more international attention focused on it. And there is a mission of the International Atomic Energy Agency led by Rafael Grossi that is visiting the plant regularly. And the new visit is expected next week. It was just announced yesterday. This was not the case with the Kakhovka dam, despite the warnings from President Zelensky and Ukrainian officials that Russians might blow it up. As long ago as October last year, Zelensky has been warning about it, and he was calling on creation of an international monitoring mission also to make sure that the situation at the Kakhovka dam is safe. It didn't happen. So while there are, there is more international oversight over the Zaporizhzhia nuclear power plant, of course, the situation is still fragile and cannot be excluded that Russians might manufacture some sort of a catastrophe there, a false flag operation to blame Ukraine, just as they did with the Kakhovka dam. We see a massive disinformation effort to put the blame on Ukraine.
There also appears, Owen, doesn't there, a willingness by the Kremlin to adversely affect Russia's own people, given the fact that the collapse of the dam has left that even more Russians will be affected than Ukrainians, because the Russians are in the east. But also the threats to blow up the Zaporizhzhia nuclear power plant could have far-reaching effects for Russian citizens.
Right. Well, let's be clear. Nobody has actually threatened to blow up the Zaporizhzhia nuclear power plant. That threat has not sounded. It's more of a warning and a fear. But in terms of destroying infrastructure that is vital to the lives of Russian citizens, yes, this is starting to look a lot like scorched earth. That actually, if you destroy a piece of infrastructure that is vital to supplying Crimea with fresh water, and the whole agricultural sector of Crimea was dependent on that canal, one of the reasons why, in fact, one of the very few practical reasons for actually taking Novokakhovka or invading Kherson Oblast in the first place was actually to secure that water supply, which had been cut off immediately after the annexation for several years in 2014. If you're just throwing that up and literally blowing up that future for your Russian Crimea, it looks as though there is not really any expectation that they're going to be able to hang on to it or have any kind of long-term concern for the citizens of Kherson, Zaporizhzhia, or all those Ukrainians that Vladimir Putin has recently declared to be Russians. They don't really appear to care. They will just apparently do anything to slow up that Ukrainian advance. And that smacks of a kind of desperate, burnt earth policy.
Owen Matthews and Olga Tokariuk, thank you so much for joining me on The Globalist. You're with Monocle Radio. It's 9:14 in Riyadh, 7:14 here in London. Now, the US Secretary of State Antony Blinken is returning to Saudi Arabia this week. His purpose is twofold. First, to take part in a meeting of the US Gulf Cooperation Council, and secondly, to co-host a meeting of the Global Coalition to Defeat ISIS. But it's the discussions on the sidelines which, as ever, are arguably the real focus, as Saudi Arabia rehabilitates itself on the world stage and the US is updating its relationship with a key player in the Middle East. Well, I'm delighted to say I'm joined by Sanam Vakil, who's Director of the Middle East and North Africa Programme at Chatham House. A very good morning to you, Sanam.
Good morning.
So just explain to us a little bit more about the two main reasons for Blinken's visit.
Well, I think above all, the visit is to reaffirm U.S.-Saudi bilateral ties. But these two meetings, the U.S.-GCC summit and the anti-ISIS multilateral meeting, are sort of an avenue for that direct conversation, which comes after tensions between Riyadh and Washington over a range of issues. But ultimately, the Biden administration has tried through a number of visits, with Blinken's being the most senior over the past year, to showcase that Saudi Arabia is an important player in the region, if not globally.
And is there that sense now, therefore, that choosing a path of deeper diplomatic engagement with Saudi Arabia is going to be just the better path in the long run, regardless as to the acute difficulties that have been experienced in the last couple of years?
Well, personally, I don't think that the U.S. ever was walking away from the relationship. They were just trying to elevate and prioritize deep human rights concerns, particularly around the killing of Jamal Khashoggi. I think at the same time, Riyadh very much pushed back on the sort of finger wagging from the West and took deep offense to what was perceived to be these, you know, dramatic differences. Underpinning the relationship, though, has been cooperation on a range of issues. And I don't think that's ever fallen to the wayside. So I think we should be quite careful in interpreting these bilateral dynamics in zero-sum ways. There's been continued cooperation, continued engagement, and the U.S.-Saudi relationship, while experiencing ups and downs as it has in the past, still remains a priority for both capitals.
Tell us a little bit more about what these areas of cooperation are.
Yes, I mean, of course, for the U.S., OPEC Plus and a stable oil price remains a key issue for the president. The U.S. government has invested a lot to support Saudi efforts to end the Yemen conflict and reaffirm the ceasefire. They have been working with the Saudis on Sudan and the conflict there and trying to support some kind of stabilization process. And of course, more broadly, Biden, through Blinken, is also interested in promoting normalization between Saudi Arabia and Israel. So that is an important part of that conversation, thinking about how the Biden administration can support Israel's greater integration to the region.
What leverage does the United States still have over Saudi Arabia?
Well, it's not about leverage. It's actually about incentives. For normalization to take place, Saudi Arabia is seeking certain incentives, and those incentives will require Washington's support. It's increasingly looking for civilian nuclear technology. It's looking to have a stronger U.S.-Saudi relationship. It's looking to reactivate the Israeli-Palestinian peace process, and that requires an American presence at the table and an American support. All of the normalization agreements between Israel and other Gulf Arab states, such as the Abraham Accords, have been triangular. The U.S. has underpinned and supported and incentivized the relationship to get off the ground. So the same thing applies here. It's not going to be the Abraham Accords. It's going to be Saudi's version of normalization. But this is a harder ask for the kingdom, because the Palestinian question is unanswered. There's no avenue for negotiations currently. And to think that Saudi Arabia is just going to turn its back on Palestine is sort of a very short-sighted and I think impossible sort of thinking. Saudi Arabia wants to be at the center of the Arab world. It's trying to showcase its relevance through all of its diplomatic maneuvering and outreach. It will try to achieve some progress on Palestine. It won't give up normalization for nothing.
It does seem to be very much in control of what's happening, doesn't it? You know, you talked there about Saudi's version of normalization and the fact that the Saudis cut oil production earlier on this week, sending very strong messages to the rest of the world about who's in control.
Yes, I mean, we are in a moment where Saudi Arabia is very clearly signaling that it is taking the lead on multiple files. It is a relevant regional player, international player, economic player. This is a Saudi moment. The question is there substance behind all of the maneuvering and activity? You know, they've been critical in Sudan. They are trying to achieve peace in Yemen. They've opened the door back to Syria's Bashar al-Assad, and they've normalized ties with Iran. It's a very ambitious portfolio, that, and all of these files require constant management in order to maintain and preserve Saudi interests. So you know, there are a lot of balls in the air.
Let's touch briefly with on Iran, because it, in the last day or so, Iran's reopened its embassy in Saudi Arabia. What does that mean for the region?
Well, I think on the surface, reconciliation between these two regional heavyweights, two very critical players, does bring down the tenor of conflict that has dominated and played out across the Middle East, from in Syria to Iraq to Yemen. So there is a lessening of tensions. The key, though, is will both capitals be able to slowly develop areas of cooperation and keep the tenor of conflict at a low level, particularly in Yemen, where the Saudis are looking to extend the ceasefire and achieve some kind of peace agreement with the Houthis that are backed by Iran.
Sanam Vakil, thank you so much as ever for joining us on Monocle Radio. Still to come on today's programme.
That voice that we have all listened to many times at hotel piano bars, and that, like football and samba, will remain associated with Brazil forever.
Brazil says goodbye to the bossa nova legend Astrid Gilberto. Stay with us on The Globalist.
UBS has over 900 investment analysts from over 100 different countries.
Over 900 of the sharpest minds and freshest thinkers in the world of finance today.
To find out how we could help you,
contact us at ubs.com.
Now let's continue with today's newspapers. Joining me now in the studio is Professor of International Relations and a regular voice here on Monocle Radio, Yossi Meckelberg. Hello.
Good morning.
How are you doing? It seems that Chatham House is making a bit of a land grab this morning. Is that correct? you just came in and you said, oh, Sanam Vakil, she's my boss. Yeah. Delighted to have you with us. Let's go through the papers. What's caught your eye, Yossi?
Well, first of all, I think that the primaries in the United States are getting more and more excited and hotting up because It's strange because it's almost a year and a half before the election, but the way that American, the cycle of American election, basically all the time in a kind of an election cycle, either is the presidential or it's the midterms. And in between, you know, every 2 years change the entire House of Representatives and the third of Senate. So you are, and then Americans elect everything from judges to the Board of Education. So it's getting said, especially on the Republican side, when Chris Christie announced his candidacy and Mike Pence. And it's interesting because there are some, you know, few firsts there. It's the first time that a former vice president goes against a former president in the primaries. And having Trump around, we know it's going to be very interesting.
Well, it's interesting because let's focus on Chris Christie for starters. I mean, he kicked off in New Hampshire yesterday, yes, didn't he? Let's just make this absolutely clear. Chris Christie had a go about 7 years ago, didn't he, to tilting at the presidency. And then swiftly, once he realised that the game was up, he was going to endorse Trump. The issue here is, and as you say, it's a really crowded field that we're experiencing now for the Republicans. We sort of have to jump ahead and to say, where will Christie go when he doesn't get the nomination? Or am I just being very mean to Chris Christie and underestimating this man?
No, you're very realistic about Chris. Okay. Chris is kind of right now the polls show that he has 1% of support. And you see, on the face of it, it looks a done deal because Trump has around 50%, some polls say 53%, some 48%, and the next round. the sound is around 24%. So you might say, oh, you know, don't bother with the primaries, there is Trump. However, considering the kind of legal troubles that Trump has between now and the election, who knows, he might be convicted by then of whatever he suits for. So this can make a huge difference. I think what we see more than candidates that can win, but candidates can be spoilers for Trump. Because some of them, like Nikki Haley, Mike Pence, Chris Christie, they know him very well. They know exactly his weaknesses. Not that we don't know most of his weaknesses, but they don't very intimately his weaknesses. And as a result, they can actually serve as spoilers there and see what happened. It's also because it's such a long haul until the primaries. Bear in mind, the convention, the Republican convention, to decide who's the candidate is only in August 2024. So between now and then, there is so much time. Cause so much trouble.
Speaking of causing trouble, the Duke of Sussex was in court yesterday. Quite astonishing scenes to see a senior member of the British royal family giving evidence in a public court.
The first time since 1891, so one every 132 years. But on the last occasion, the person in there was actually eventually a king. This is not going to happen in this case. But I think it's very much about the royal family. It's about journalism. It's about the tabloids and how you treat. On the one hand, you start doubting from the cross-examination if there is real hardcore evidence about, especially from Prince Harry, whether his phone was hacked. On the other hand, you ask about the etiquette, the morality of the intrusion into the private life of someone that lost his mother at a very young age. And he's angry, he's bitter, and you can really understand. But he also entered into places that he talks about the press and the government being at rock bottom, coming from a royal, though we know he's living across the pond right now. He's really hurt by the intrusion into this privacy. And I think, you know, especially when you think that the editor of the Mirror at the time was Piers Morgan, that is, you know, probably the most sanctimonious presenter on British TV, maybe it would have been time just for more than a court case for reflection about the role of tabloids and journalism generally vis-a-vis people, especially their private life.
And one wonders, you have the dignity of royalty that you have to also maintain, and this is not going to be reflected in any of the press coverage, because let's face it, if you want to have a go at the press, which he is doing in a court of law, the press isn't going to report, you know, it will have to legally report accurately and fairly and contemporaneously, but the Daily Mail might have different ideas, as will the Times. There's not one sympathetic headline towards him today, which is arguably a sort of a soft power misjudgment.
I find it quite sad about, maybe not that I have much expectations about the tabloids, but I've seen in this sense, instead being, you know, this is a young person that has gone through a lot from losing his mother, the intrusion. He blames the tabloids for winning his first serious relationship. Now the intrusion, you know, the feeling of the racist approach towards his current wife. He finds that actually he can't live in the country of his birth and where he served and risked his life in Afghanistan. So you can understand his anger, but not so sure whether he directs his anger in the right way.
Finally, let's cover this immediate headache for the 216 passengers and 16 crew stuck in eastern Russia on an Air India flight that had to make an emergency landing. Not what you want.
Not for a flight that aimed to land in San Francisco, no. An Air American passenger. And that's what events take over something, politics. And you know, are we in a situation that the Russians would, you know, do what they should do according to international law and law to a replacement airplane to take all the passengers without any fuss? Or said, oh, we might be in a kind of diplomatic hostage situation. As we think, you know, we know the case of the famous American basketball player that was sentenced for 10 years for a very minor offense and the rest. And there is an American journalist now in Russian jail. And especially when we all talk about, you know, what happened, the disaster with the dam yesterday and the counteroffensive. And I think this might be a crucial moment of something which just a case of an accident, how it's going to pan out and how they are going to deal it diplomatically, either to do it the right things and let the airplane and the passenger go, or will escalate it.
The fact that it's, very briefly, but the fact that this is an Air India flight and India has not criticised Vladimir Putin and the invasion of Ukraine. They have kept very much on the sidelines. One wonders whether that will be the diplomatic way out of all this. One hopes it is, at least.
One hopes so. They said one get also India on the case of Russia. But I think for many of us that have some passports that are not welcomed by certain countries, when we fly through with airlines above that, it crosses your mind what happens if something goes wrong.
Oh, yes, one does look down, doesn't one? Yossi Meckelberg, thank you so much for joining me on the programme. You're listening to The Globalist with me, Emma Nelson, live on Monocle Radio. The time here in London is 7:30 a.m. Let's have a quick recap of the day's headlines. The former New Jersey Governor Chris Christie has entered the 2024 race for the White House. Although it's not believed Mr. Christie will secure the nomination, it's suggested his candidacy will further unsettle the Republicans' ability to choose their next nominee for the White House. The former Vice President Mike Pence is expected to announce his candidacy later. Italy's far-right Prime Minister has travelled to Tunisia to discuss the issue of irregular migration. Giorgia Meloni's visit follows a call between her and President Kais Saied earlier this week to address border surveillance. And hundreds of passengers on board an Air India flight from New Delhi to San Francisco face a tense wait after an engine problem has forced them to land in the far east of Russia. It's not known what the Russian authorities plan to do with the 216 passengers and 16 crew on board the Boeing 777, especially those carrying passports from countries seen as hostile to Russia. Air India says it's sending a replacement plane. This is The Globalist. Stay tuned. Now, as Ukraine continues its battle against Russia's full-scale invasion, many military analysts have warned that a faltering Russian military performance risks pushing Vladimir Putin closer to the dangerous path of nuclear escalation. So is the West, in part, afraid of a Ukrainian victory? At this year's GlobeSec Security Conference, Monocle's Andrew Muller sat down with Rob de Weijg, who's the founder of the Hague Centre at Leiden University. Andrew began by asking Rob if there's actually a danger that we're getting too confident or complacent about Ukraine's chances of military success.
The point is that I'm deeply involved, also behind the scenes in my country, on the issue of Ukraine. Most experts simply do not see an outright victory for Ukraine right now, unfortunately. I wish it could happen tomorrow. The point is that we do not define success. What is it? There is no definition about success, so that's a problem.
The Ukrainians have a definition of success.
The Ukrainians have a definition, but I always ask the question, how? How are we going to do that? That's also the question I raised in the Netherlands within the ministries I'm working for. And we produce papers now to discuss undesired outcomes. Everybody should do so, because this is about planning. There is one day we should move from providing arms, supplying weaponry, to deterrence. How are we going to do that? What are we going to do if there is a ceasefire? Do we then move forward with NATO membership or other arrangements leading to, how to put it, security guarantees? How are we going to do that? These are the fundamental questions, and everybody knows it, and that's the elephant in the room. Everybody knows it.
Are you worried that there is a certain, I guess, culture of groupthink starting to develop around
Ukraine? It's in a way, it's a tunnel vision. It's a tunnel vision, and it's a kind of groupthink, and I understand it. So I'm not going to blame anyone for this, because I'm not going to raise the question, the awkward questions too. But we have to think about it. If we don't do it, we might end up in a major war in Europe. And for example, F-16s, I'm in favor of that. But then we also have to think about the question, what comes after the F-16? What is it? Ground troops? You tell me. You have to discuss those questions. Those questions are ignored constantly. You cannot discuss them at a conference like this. But behind the scenes, for that reason, the corridors are extremely important here. I had a discussion, many, many discussions with good friends I know for many, many years on this. And they all say the same, we have to discuss it. And we discuss it behind the scenes. And that is important. So the importance of this conference is what happens on the stage, but also what happens in the corridors of the conference. For me, that is crucial. And what von der Leyen just said was remarkable, and that should be done on the stage.
But how would you sum up the tone and the content of those corridor conversations then?
Worrying. People are worried, especially people who have responsibilities.
Mm.
And they're not certain about the outcome. And the reason is quite simple. If you look, or the explanation is quite simple, if you look what von der Leyen said, she said, we are struggling with our defense industrial base. We're struggling to produce 1 million rounds of grenades. Okay. The US produces almost 15,000 rounds per month. What the European Union does is unclear, but it's limited. And during an offensive, Ukraine uses 250,000 rounds per month. So there is a mismatch. So we have a problem with our defense industrial bases because we neglected it over the last 30 years. This is something Putin knows. So there is a problem of providing enough weaponry and especially ammunition in the future. How are we going to do that? We have to think about that.
I mean, is it the case that it is just starting to dawn on people that a similar recalibration of European industry is necessary, I guess, similar to the really quite extraordinary recalibration of European energy infrastructure that we've seen in the last 16 months?
I agree.
A couple of other people we've spoken to have said Europe does need to get much more self-sufficient as a defence manufacturer.
Absolutely. I completely agree with that. The problem is, how fast can we do it? It's always a matter of timing.
Mm.
I'm a former defense official. I was made partly responsible for drafting the plans of the restructuring of the Dutch armed forces after the end of the Cold War, a long time ago. Reducing armed forces is easy. Building armed forces up is really cumbersome. It requires 10 to 15 years. We don't have that time right now. That's the problem. Luckily, Russia has a similar problem, but we simply do not know how big the problem of Russia is.
That was Rob de Veg there in conversation with Monocle's Andrew Muller. You're with The Globalist on Monocle Radio. It's 8:38 in Paris, which is where we head next, because deciding what a country's military needs could be in 10 or 20 years requires not just a good deal of foresight, but also a touch of clairvoyance. Who could anticipate where or how we will be fighting our wars in the decades to come? Well, France's lower house of parliament, the National Assembly, votes today on the next military budget, which envisages an increase in spending until 2030. Beyond that is a so-called innovation budget. And in order to prepare France for the future of combat, President Emmanuel Macron has been doing his homework by reading science fiction. I'm joined down the line from Paris by the journalist and author Agnès Pailler. Good morning, Agnès.
Good morning.
So just explain to us, what has Monsieur Macron been reading?
Well, it's very intriguing, but apparently he's not the only head of state to read science fiction to actually understand better how, the French army, or I'm sure President Biden, is devouring those science fiction writing. It's very interesting. You mentioned that innovation budget, which is quite colossal, 10 billion euros, at least as far as the French army is concerned. And there's a tiny envelope, 2 million euros, given to a team, the Red Team project in France. And they are published authors. You know, the requirement is that they have at least published one science fiction novel. And And they are paid to actually produce dystopian plots and narratives, and two of them are going to be published next year. Of course, they will be have been emptied out from all confidential elements. And it's really to help experts and analysts to expand their horizons and to think out of the box. It's very interesting because, I mean, you could think, you know, this is all very well, but it's a bit of a gimmick, it's a bit of a gadget. Will those novels really have an impact? Well, they have. For instance, recently in a story called After the Carbonic Night, there was an idea of, you know, how the attacks by pirates of an old and aging aircraft carrier. And here you might be thinking about the Charles de Gaulle aircraft carrier, which will very soon finish its life, and it will build a new next generation aircraft carrier. Well, apparently, and that's what the spokesperson from the French army said, that thanks to those writers who imagined those attacks from very close to the ship, there is an area, a perimeter around the warship that is apparently very vulnerable to attacks. So they have made modification, all the experts, the engineers, for the next aircraft. So you see, I mean, it's not pure imagination, pure abstraction.
It does seem like a rather French thing to do, though, or am I generalising there? You said that other nations read science fiction, but to actually have a department that writes pure science fiction in order to help the army, I mean, is that exclusively French?
No, it's not. As I said before, the Americans do it. Of course, they have Hollywood, you know, good source of imagination and great talents. The British are at it too, but not surprisingly, they didn't ask for British authors. They hired two very well-known science fiction writers, Peter Singer and August Kohl, to think similar dystopian novels. But what is interesting, yes, you're right, the French are doing it the French way. That is to say, the main difference is that the Americans and the British tend to concentrate on the technology. So all those novels are very rich in, you know, technology, gadgets, you know, a la James Bond, if you like. Was the French team, the Red Team, imagine that, they have two anthropologists, and they have philosophers, and they have sociologists in their team also advising and helping the writers with their plots and narratives. And so, yes, that's the French twist. Well, in the end, you know, will it make an impact in the next war? As President Macron said, it's important to be one war ahead rather than one war behind. So we'll see.
Agnès Parier, thank you as ever for joining us on Monocle Radio. You with The Globalist.
UBS is a global financial services firm with over 150 years of heritage. Built on the unique dedication of our people, we bring fresh thinking and perspective to our work. We know that it takes a marriage of intelligence and heart to create lasting value for our clients. It's about having the right ideas, of course, but also about having one of the most accomplished systems and an unrivaled network of global experts. That's why at UBS, we pride ourselves on thinking smarter to make a real difference. Tune in to The Bulletin with UBS every week for the latest insights and opinions from UBS all around the world.
Let's talk business now with Vicky Price, economist and former joint head of the UK government's economic service. I'm delighted to say she joins us now. Welcome back to Monocle Radio, Vicky.
Thank you. Good morning.
Let's head to Mexico, first of all. Mexico desperately trying to incentivise and get inward investment.
Yes, but of course, what it's also concerned about is the difference that exists between the north and the south of the country. So a lot of what it's talking about now is creating a number of new industrial zones, industrial parks, to attract businesses to the south of the country with all sorts of incentives, which include the tax breaks if you're there, sort of VAT reductions and other help, and encouraging firms to turn up there and invest on condition, of course, those tax breaks, that they would create a number of jobs. And I think they are well aware that there is not very much more they can do in the north. The interesting thing is that there is, of course, a drought in the country in the north, and attracting any more firms up there is not going to be fantastically feasible anyway, because that bit of the country is already under some sort of stress. But the south, the difference in GDP between the north and the south is very significant. And they do, of course, have all sorts of reasons for arguing that this is actually going to be very good for firms that come to those areas as well. Because really what we're talking about is doing something about what is called the sort of inter-oceanic corridor with that bit of the economy, in fact, which is actually possibly quite exciting for anyone who may come there. 10 new industrial parks, and that can actually make quite a big difference for them. But, it remains to be seen how quickly anyone responds. And as we know, there is now a global agreement anyway not to reduce corporation tax rates below 15% for multinationals. But I think the way they're going about it is a little bit like the way quite a lot of other countries have now moved. Not only is the UK, of course, has announced free ports and new industrial areas, but also, of course, the US, which is very heavily subsidizing particular sectors of the economy, particularly the green side. So there is a feeling, I mean, across the world that one needs to also respond to that. Otherwise, everything will go to the US.
I mean, internationally, how tempting a prospect is Mexico?
Well, it's A, quite a big country. B, the connectivity is quite extraordinary. So if you look at exactly where those developments are, I mean, the whole thing is, of course, you know, connecting the Pacific and the Atlantic, which is quite important for them. And if indeed it develops into something, into a serious corridor for trade, I think that would be quite an important development for Mexico itself, but also I think for world trade more generally. So yes, it is important, and of course it is part of the overall agreement in terms of how trade is conducted between the US and Canada and Mexico. So there is a lot of freedom of trade between those three, with the new arrangements that have been made, admittedly changed a little bit from how they were. You know, Trump, if you remember, sort of renegotiated their free trade agreements between those three nations. But Mexico is certainly benefiting from that itself.
Let's have a look at a British institution, the Confederation of British Industry, which has been exposed as having deep, deep issues when it comes to misconduct, internal misconduct. Its existence is on the line, isn't it? But its members seem to have backed it in a vote.
Yes, it's gone through a sort of existential crisis, we could say, because we're just talking about Mexico and the need to develop more industry. I mean, here in the UK, of course, it has been quite an issue as to whether businesses have been listened to over the last few years. And there was a famous sort of quote from, or at least a phrase from previous Prime Minister Boris Johnson, when he showed quite clearly that he didn't want to listen to business. But this is very important. If business doesn't operate, then you can't have an economy working. And unfortunately, the biggest representative of businesses, the trade body called the Confederation of British Industry, had gone into difficulties, particularly on allegations of sexual harassment and even more sort of sexual scandals that came out in the last few months. And the result had been that the government and the opposition in the UK stopped talking to them, and they had to restructure and have a new head come in. And the plans for changing their governance, if you like, and changing their attitudes just went to a vote yesterday. It seems that the businesses that still remain, a number of them have stopped even being members, but a very large number are still there, have decided that those plans made sense. They have been given all sorts of concessions of greater intervention by them in the future, which is good news. In the meantime, of course, you've still got loads of other trade organizations in the UK which can easily communicate with government, but they don't quite have the same sort of depth and also breadth of types of big firms which really matter very much for the economy. So good news for them in a way, but it still needs to be seen whether the government decides to start talking to them again. So there's a bit more and a bit further to go, frankly.
Vicky Price, thank you so much as ever for joining us on Monocle Radio. You are the Globalist. We head now to Brazil. The bossa nova legend Astrid Gilberto died on Monday, aged 83. She's known for singing the English version of The Girl from Ipanema, and she helped to popularise the genre internationally. Well, Monocle's Fernanda Augusta Pacheco has paid tribute to her and to the many Brazilian music queens that have died recently, marking the end of an era.
Yes, he would give his heart gladly. She walks to the sea. She looks straight ahead, not at me.
Oh, how I will miss this voice that sounds like the most magical summer breeze you can possibly think of. Rest in peace, Astrud Gilberto, who has died at the age of 83. The bossa nova icon was responsible for popularizing the genre internationally. She's the voice of the English version for The Girl from Ipanema. That voice that we have all listened to many times at hotel piano bars, and that, like football and samba, will remain associated with Brazil forever. Her gentle and soothing voice influenced many. She was the first Brazilian female singer to win a Grammy for the record The Girl from Ipanema. But it wasn't just Astrud Gilberto who died recently. A whole generation of Brazilian music queens have passed away, leaving me with a sense of emptiness. Singers that I grew up listening to as a child, that every Brazilian can sing along to. Only a few weeks ago, Brazil's Queen of Rock, Rita Lee, died. Oh, her irreverence will be missed. Rita was revolutionary, singing about sex and lust in a special way. She had many songs banned during the Brazilian dictatorship. And what about another personal favorite, Gal Costa, one of the flag bearers for Brazil's Tropicália movement, which is pure counterculture. Brazil's music scene really has to thank all those incredible women who in their different ways helped to shape a nation. From Monaco, I'm Fernando Augusto Pacheco.
That would be very nice, someone to love me right. That would be very nice, someone to understand. Each little dream in me, someone...
My thanks to Fernando Augusto Pacheco for that. You're listening to The Globalist. Finally, on today's programme, this year Copenhagen celebrates the 10th edition of 3 Days of Design. Almost 300 design brands will showcase new work as part of the event. Monocle's design editor, Nick Manise, is part of the Monocle team out there. A very good morning to you, Nick. How is Copenhagen?
It is delightful, Emma Nelson. The sun is out. People are in shorts and T-shirt. And there's good design on show as well. You really could not ask for much more.
It's a place that really puts a little spring in one step, isn't it?
Seriously, and you know, it's like you can kind of, I have to be careful saying this sort of stuff because I'm worried it makes me sound like I'm just having an absolute lark. But you know, you can finish your day's work and then go for a swim in the harbour and then come back out and have dinner with some very talented designers. It is an amazing place to be at the moment.
You're often checking in from rather wonderful places. I do pity you and your dreadfully hard work. Right, let's focus on 3 Days of Design. What is it?
So it's a design festival that takes place over 3 days. That sounded sarcastic. It's essentially, it was started in 2013 as a, I guess, a response to the typical trade hall driven trade fairs where, you know, you'd go to these big halls on the outskirts of the city and look at furniture in a temporary environment that's only set up for a number of days, and then everyone would pack up their stalls and it would be like the event never existed at all. 3 days of design, what they tried to do instead was, and you know, drawing on inspiration from Milan's Design Week, which has the trade hall component, but also perhaps the most popular part of it is the displays in showrooms around the city. 3 days of design just took that part of the model. So it's essentially just furniture shows in existing showrooms. The idea being that brands use the spaces that they already have, use the resources that they already have. You know, there's a sustainability angle to that, but I think also for people and for visitors, the chance to, I guess, wander from showroom to showroom and see the city and be in the city and amongst, you know, all these other people just caring about their day-to-day life, because that's where design takes place. It takes place in our day-to-day lives. So to be able to do that really changes your experience and your perception of furniture.
Just tell us a little bit about what we're going to see on show here. Is this an exclusively Scandinavian or Danish affair?
No, so it's certainly leans Scandinavian. I mean, this is, I guess, Copenhagen really is the hub for Scandinavian and Nordic design. All the big brands, you know, tend to have their showrooms here, and lots of them, you know, well maybe headquartered in their more traditional smaller towns across the country, do tend to have an enormous presence in Copenhagen. So certainly they're represented, but brands from elsewhere, whilst they maybe don't have showrooms here, might find a gallery space to show in. And I'm trying to think. Kiori, for instance, is a Japanese brand who have taken over Ogreen Studios, which is a studio-like space. They've put their installation in there. And it is a global mix, but certainly leaning towards the Scandinavian market. So for a brand like Kiori, it's a chance to, I guess, try and inject themselves not only into, I guess, people's minds and put themselves in front of Scandinavian designers and architects who are seeing these showrooms, but also sort of put themselves into the city. It's a great chance to test to see if this is a place where you might want to set up a shop or showroom.
Indeed. I mean, the fact is we've already established that Copenhagen is a lovely place to be, and also it's a very design focused place when you're there. You know, everything works because someone has thought about how things work. How does that sort of frame the event itself?
I mean, I was reflecting on this yesterday. We've written, the Monocle team here has produced a lovely newsletter for our Monocle Minute, which is going to come out this evening. But as part of that, I guess I was reflecting on this city and why this event is you know, there's the design calendar is packed. There are so many things you can pick and choose from. But why is 3 days of design so appealing? And for me, it's because Denmark, I guess, is this country at a design crossroads, or it could be at a design crossroads, you know. It's a nation with these celebrated 20th century design and designers and architects. It feels like you can barely take a step in the city without, you know, bumping into a light or a chair or a table or a building by Arne Jacobsen or Jørn Utzon or Bodil Kjær. You've got all of that here, but at the same time, there's all these emerging established contemporary designers like Cecily Mans or Bjarke Engels, but there's emerging talents here too, and you really are seeing that all come together at this festival. So, you know, if you drop past, I went to Louis Paulsen yesterday, and yeah, they've got lights by Werner Panton on display, but then they've also worked with an emerging brand called Home in Heaven to make a new take on Werner Panton's work. So you have these brands that, yes, they're in touch with their heritage. They understand where they've come from. They understand what's made this country such a great design.
Nick, we're going to let you go.
But because you can't rest on your laurels. I'm done.
Nick, we've run out of time. Thank you so much for joining us on the line from Copenhagen. That's all we have time for today. Thanks to the producer, Sophie Munhan Coombs, and the studio manager, Steph Chungu. I'm Emma Nelson. Goodbye. Thanks for listening.